people seeking, trying to seek refuge in other countries. If the state ceases to function, this will provoke a crisis that is much bigger than humanitarian.
The UNHCR has reported nearly 500,000 internally displaced Afghan citizens inside Afghanistan. Their houses were bombarded by the US and the former Afghan Air Force during clashes with the Taliban in major urban centers like Kandahar, Herat, and Kunduz. Rest of Afghanistan largely fell to the Taliban after the US-trained Afghan army surrendered without any fighting.
We must make sure that displaced people can either go back to their homes, and some people are going back to their homes, or if they are displaced, they are under a shelter. And you know, many are not. Many are out in the open, sleeping rough.
Analysts point out that the real problem in Afghanistan is deteriorating economy, as Afghan financial system has been dependent at least 60% on foreign aid. With the change of guard in Kabul, the Western countries and the UN have resumed funding, which is far less than what the new government requires to stabilize the fragile economy. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
One of the world's largest democracies, and on the wall of the parliament, which represent democracy, there is a sentence which reads Vasudeva Kutumbakam. It means the world is one family, and this is considered the most important moral value of the Indian society. But this is apparently not the case anymore, considering the growing discord in the society. In recent months, attacks against Muslim hawkers have come under the spotlight in social media. Critics say hate crimes against Muslims increased after the emergence of the Hindu nationalist government of the ruling BJP.
In India, from over close to a decade, the Muslim poor community is being further marginalized. This is being done by boycotting the Muslim hawkers and small Muslim traders.
Experts say in India the political notion has changed from a strong secular nation to a theocratic Hindu nation, which has given rise to violence against Muslims. Now Hindu extremists have been busy running this show through social media. Experts say the country, which is apparently known as the world's largest democracy, is under grave danger of losing this title. In a nation of diverse ethnic and religious groups, now even beggars are being humiliated and intimidated just because of their faith, and are asked to leave the country since they are Muslims. Based on reports by several rights groups, since the ruling BJP came to power in 2014, it has adopted various laws and taken actions that legitimize discrimination against the religious minorities and stigmatize critics of the government. Experts believe it could lead to instability in the world's most populous nation.
Everything is being done to further marginalize Muslims, including hate speeches, hate crimes, mob lynching, the citizenship law, criminalizing divorce, etc. Now they are picking on traders and vendors to weaken the Muslim community economically.
The ruling party of the Prime Minister Modi has fervently denied any discrimination against the community, saying India is a democracy and believes in equal rights for all. But critics say Prime Minister Modi's slogan of everyone together, development for all, and everyone's trust is nothing but a political tool to appease the voters as usual. Munawar Zaman, Press TV, New Delhi.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip took part in Friday prayer in front of the headquarters of the Red Cross. The event, organized by different Palestinian factions, aims to support Palestinian prisoners who are subjected to Israeli abuse.
We are here to stress that we will not disappoint our Palestinian prisoners, and we will keep supporting them. Our prisoners are passing through difficult times inside the jails as the regime is attacking the prisoners, especially Islamic Jihad members.
Meanwhile, Palestinians consider the recent heroic escape operation of six prisoners from an Israeli jail as a slap in the face of Israel.
We are doing our best to release Palestinian prisoners, and this is an oath that we should stick with until all Palestinian inmates are free. We are working round the clock to hold meetings and put plans so we can liberate our prisoners and have them run us and with their families. Our resistance made a firm decision that the six Palestinian inmates that escaped Jilbo prison are on top of any coming exchange deal.
The Palestinian resistance mentors the behavior of the Israeli regime towards the prisoners inside the jails and those who remain free, demanding the international institutions to put pressure on Israel regarding the prisoners' issue.
The issue of our inmates inside Israeli jails is ongoing, and there are still two of the six heroic escapees out of the Israeli prison. We are here to express our total support for those inmates and all Palestinian prisoners who are fighting to achieve their demands.
Palestinians here stress they will remain committed to their duty of supporting prisoners and demanding their release. The issue of Palestinian inmates is a priority for Palestinians, who will keep demanding their release until they regain complete freedom. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Demonstrations have hit Aden and other cities in southern Yemen. The protests came in response to the deterioration of public services and widespread poverty within areas controlled by the Saudi-led coalition's forces, but the demonstrations were met with a crackdown and resulted in deaths and injuries of protesters.
It is clear that the Saudi-backed regime has failed in handling of the economy, and this is what prompted people to go out and demonstrate in the southern governorates. The price of the dollar in Aden is two times more than what it is in Sana'a, and this confirms that former fugitive president Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi is implementing the agenda of the Saudi-led coalition, which seeks to control Yemeni lands and destroy the country.
The governor of Aden, Tariq Salam, said what is happening in southern cities is the revolution of the poor that will only end with the departure of all the forces of the Saudi-led coalition, including the Emirati-backed Southern Transitional Council, which controls the city of Aden.
Yemenis took to the streets of Aden to create a major popular uprising aimed at confronting the Emirati occupation authorities. And this is a result of the suffering experienced by the people of Aden due to the absence of public services, such as electricity, inflation, and high prices. This is the revolution of the hungry, and it will end when all the Saudi coalition's forces leave Yemeni lands.
6 years ago, the Saudi-led coalition occupied several cities in southern Yemen, including Aden. Since then, these areas have been paralyzed by a power struggle between the Saudi-backed Hadi government and the UAE-backed Southern Transitional Council.
The catastrophic situation in southern regions of Yemen has pushed people there to stage out and demand expelling the foreign powers. Observers say people have come to realize that the Saudi-led coalition's presence has only increased the misery in their country, where more than 20 million people rely on aid. Abdulatif Roshali, Sana'a.
Since the beginning of the struggle for independence in Indian-controlled Kashmir in 1989, journalists in the troubled region have worked in dangerous conditions. The fraternity has often faced tremendous pressure from all sides, while many journalists lost their lives in the line of duty. New Delhi stripped Kashmir of its special status in 2019. Since then, the fraternity has accused the Indian administration in Kashmir of using intimidation, surveillance, interference, and policing.
I think this is an attempt to treat journalists as enemy, the adversarial relationship that is there between the organs of the state and media as a fraternity is very adversarial at the moment, since last 2-3 years. And this is a result of, you know, when you treat journalists whose only job is to tell story and who are storytellers and who are not responsible for the story. They are treating, as we call the shooting the messenger.
According to the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, the freedom of speech and expression in Kashmir is under threat. Michelle Bachelet has also criticized India for pressuring journalists and frequent communications blackout in Jammu and Kashmir. However, India has often rejected any criticism relating to Jammu and Kashmir. Editor-in-Chief of Kashmirwala, an independent media outlet of Kashmir, says his organization has several police cases registered against them.
In the last 2 years, we have been multiple times called, summoned, questioned, interrogated or detained. And other than that, there are a lot of other things that happen behind the curtains. You get phone calls, you get people who meet you and they tell you that this thing should not be done, that should not be done. So that creates this sense of fear in you. You always have to look over your shoulder as a journalist at what is going to happen.
The new breed of journalists in Kashmir say journalism has been criminalized by authorities in Kashmir, and many of them, like Asif Amin, are being compelled by their parents to opt for other career options. Journalists in Kashmir say New Delhi is trying to control media outlets and newspapers. They say their career is in danger. But many analysts believe in an era that almost every individual owns a smartphone and has access to social media, controlling a narrative is impossible. Shahana Bhatt, Internet Minister at Kashmir.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting. an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick, and healed, and made well, and afflicted, and sat upon the throne, and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate Thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for Thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to Thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to Thee, to be joyful in worshipping Thee, to be desirous of Thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me Thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom Thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Kaveh Tafwai. In as many times, Israel has threatened Iran again. Iran's new defense minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Qarai Ashtiani, has reacted strongly, vowing a crushing response to any imprudent move. Why has Israel's war of words against the Islamic Republic intensified in recent months? Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the reasons behind Israeli threats and the double standard behind their accusations against Iran of pursuing nuclear weapons when the regime itself is sitting on more than 100 nuclear warheads at a minimum. First, let's cross on over to Ramallah to talk to Mona Kandil about the latest threats that are coming. We're looking at the increase, Mona, when it comes to the threats by Israeli officials against Iran. Perhaps you could name some of them. Go ahead, Mona.
Yes, that's right. Israeli officials, the threats against Iran are not stopping. They are continuing. Israel's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Yair Lapid, was in a visit to Moscow, and after a meeting with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, he said that Iran and its nuclear capabilities pose a threat not only to Israel, but also to the whole world. He also tried to show that the whole world has a problem with Iran, not only Israel. And he said he's trying to incite against Iran, saying that the world must act in order to stop Iran from having nuclear capability. And if they don't do this, then Israel reserves the right to act. Before his statements, there were similar statements also from Israeli Minister of Military Affairs. Israeli Minister of Military Affairs Benny Gantz also said that he doesn't rule out the possibility that Israel will have to take action against Iran in the future in order to prevent a nuclear Iran. At the time, they are continuing their crimes and continuing to obtain more weapons from the whole world. They are threatening Iran to the extreme, maybe, especially with the continuing and the renewed threats coming from different Israeli political officials.
Thank you very much for that, Monica Ndiol from Occupied Ramallah. Let me bring our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman, who joins us from Washington. Also joining us, historian, analyst, and author Marcus Papadopoulos, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'm going to start with you first, Michael Springman, if I may, going with what our correspondent there said, the most recent Israeli threat, and I'm going to quote how Yair Lapid, who went to Moscow earlier this month, said the following: the world needs to stop Iran from getting a nuclear capability, no matter the price. And he added, if the world doesn't do it, Israel reserves the right to act. What do you think he means?
Well, he means that he will, Israel, the apartheid entity, will act against Iran with the support of the United States and attack any nuclear installations or any nuclear scientists that it deems will be necessary to put an end to the imaginary Iranian nuclear program. Iran is enriching uranium to a limited extent. As a result of the Americans breaking the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, and somehow the Americans and their Israeli masters are focused on this in order to divert attention from the colossal number of atomic bombs the Americans have and the outrageous number that the Israelis have, 100, 200, as many as the British do, 300 or 400. Nobody seems to know. And, of course, as long as they keep talking about Iran and Iran's nuclear program and Iran's nuclear weapons that don't exist except in the Israeli mind, if they have a mind, it's going to be more of the same. The best offense is the best defense is a good offense. And the Israelis keep pushing this, and the Israelis and the news media around the world keep doing the same. So you hear only one side of the story. You hear only one bit of propaganda, Hasbara, explaining that the Israelis are so good at.
We're going to talk about some of the other threats that Israel has made against Iran, Marcus Papadopoulos. But basically, it appears that in recent months, Israel's war of wars against Iran has escalated in terms of its threats. At least that's the impression that we have based on the number of threats it has leveled against Iran. Why do you think that it's on the increase?
Well, such is the temerity of the Israeli authorities that they never fail to provoke the ire of right-thinking people across the world. Because here we have Israel, a member of the United Nations, routinely threatening another member of the United Nations, in this case, Iran. Such disgusting, despicable behaviour runs contrary to the very essence of the United Nations. Indeed, in an ideal world, Israel, along with its patrons, America and Britain, would be expelled from the UN. But, alas, the ideal is not always attainable, and in this case, there is no chance, of course, of Israel or America or Britain being expelled from the United Nations. But it is certainly the case that over the last few months, the threats stemming from Tel Aviv, the tirades of abuse emanating from Tel Aviv against Iran has increased. And whilst there is nothing new to this verbal abuse from Israel and from the threatening language from Israel, whilst it cannot be discounted, on the other hand, I don't believe there's anything for the Iranian government to be unduly concerned about, because it is my submission that Israel is, to put it simply, desperate. Israel understands that Iran is a very strong country with very strong friends and allies in the world. Iran, for instance, has a strategic partnership with Russia. Iran has very close relations with China. The Israelis are also aware that America does not want to become embroiled in a war with Iran. So it is certainly the case that there is no public will or mood in America for a war with Iran. So the Israelis, in my opinion, are desperate. And I would also add as well how ironic, how laughable it is for Israel, a country which has nuclear weapons and which refuses to sign the non-proliferation treaty, is arguing that if Iran develops nuclear weapons, which the Iranian government has no intention of doing, then Tel Aviv will take action against Iran. It is really quite breathtaking, the audacity of the Israelis. But then, Israel is the main conduit for American and British power in the Middle East. Therefore, the American and British establishments, the politicians and the mainstream journalists, allow Israel to get away with whatever it wants. No matter how dangerous and how destabilizing a force Israel is in the Middle East and in the wider world, all that matters to the Americans and the British is that Israel ensures Western supremacy in the Middle East.
Okay. Iran has also said, Michael Springman, that Israel is desperate. I'd like to zoom in on what Iran's new defense minister has said, General Mohammad Rezaghjani, about the threats leveled against Iran. He said the enemies of the Iranian nation will definitely receive a crushing response for any imprudent and reckless action that will incur heavy costs. And within that, he also said new technologies and domestic innovations are meant to ensure national security and to respond to any external aggression. Aside from the fact that Israeli threats are against international law, what is your view about the way that Iran has reacted in terms of the rebuttal or their reaction to Israeli threats?
Well, Iran's reaction and its public statements about these maniacal Israeli threats has been remarkably restrained and limited and not engaged in hyperbole of any kind so much as the Israelis do. It's very clear that when I was in Iran 3.5 years ago, I spoke with a well-connected individual who said that Iran knows exactly what the Israelis and the Americans are doing, and the Israelis and the Americans know Iran's strength, but because of their overweening arrogance, they persist in their threats against Iran, against the United Nations Charter, Article 2. And I think also, the man told me that they would, Iran would most likely have a limited response to any provocation or attacks, and it would escalate attacks on Israel and the United States as they escalated their attacks on Iran. And he said ultimately, in the end, they would target the heavily Zionist populations, centers of Israel. And of course, the Americans have all these hostages in the region. 10,000 servicemen at Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar, 20,000 sailors and Marines in the 5th Fleet steaming up and down the Persian Gulf. And in Manama, the capital of the repressive and repulsive country, if you can call it that, of Bahrain. So I think on the whole, Iran has been astonishingly restrained in its responses. And lets the Lord speak for themselves.
Well, this is what then confuses this scenario, Marcus Papadopoulos, when it comes to the one that's leveling these threats, namely Israel. You're looking at a regime of which they recently assassinated an Iranian nuclear scientist using the most recent report indicating they used AI. And some Israeli officials have even bragged about the fact that this operation was carried out. And when you take a look at the response, it's barely there, if any, from the international community, if you want to call it that. You're looking at, again, a regime that's sitting on a pile of nuclear warheads, a regime that has carried out assassinations not only within Iran on a number of occasions, but also in other parts of the world. Not a very positive report card. So why is Iran the bad guy, and yet Israel is the one that can go around doing what it's doing?
Well, when we hear the term international community, we are not, of course, referring to the United Nations. No, the international community really refers to Western powers, America, Britain, Canada, France, and Germany. That is who the international community is. And as to why Iran is the country which is vilified, despite the fact that Iran has not attacked another country in modern times, and despite the fact that Iran does not violate the sovereignty of other countries, unlike for Israel, all comes down to the fact that Iran is a strategic partner of Russia's. Iran is the linchpin in the resistance movement to Israeli aggression in the Middle East. And of course, Israel and of course Iran pursues an independent foreign policy and does not submit to the threats and diktats emanating from Washington. And on top of that is the fact that Iran is located in a geostrategic part of the world. Iran's geostrategic importance is absolutely enormous, because if Iran was pursuing an independent foreign policy in an obscure part of the world, then we would not have witnessed the vilification of Iran and the Iranian people by the West that we have witnessed for some 42 years now. It is all because Iran is in a geostrategic part of the world. Iran opposes America, Iran opposes Israel, and that is why Iran is targeted by the West and, of course, Israel. And when it comes to the United Nations, regrettably, many of the bodies which comprise the United Nations have fallen under the influence of the Americans and the British. And as a result of that, those bodies rarely, if ever, castigate Israel. Even though Israel feels so emboldened in this day and age,
well, that's the problem,
that it doesn't, that it makes its threats public against any country in the world, such as Syria and Iran.
Well, that's the problem. Israel has become emboldened, but it's been carrying that type of posture, Michael Springman, because it's been allowed to do what it has been doing. It's broken the most UN resolutions, and the rap list that I mentioned are missing a few other violations that Israel has occurred, even though it hasn't claimed responsibility. But Iran's nuclear facilities have come under attack. We could also talk about the way that Israel obviously violates the rights of Palestinians. That's another crime that's been going on for quite some time. What else can I tell you about Israel in terms of what it's done? We mentioned the assassination of Iran's nuclear scientists. So it reaches a point where Iran, you know, could react to what Israel is saying. The other thing I wanted to mention was how Israel is attacking Syria for, what, 2 or 3 years now at this point, continuously. So here you have this regime that is capable of carrying out military action. When is that threshold going to pass for Iran, do you think? I mean, where do you think that red line is going to cross?
Well, I think the red line is basically the control of the Western news media by Zionists. I read an article, admittedly it was an old one, recently by Philip Weiss of the website Mondo Weiss, and he said that just about everywhere he worked, in newspapers and in magazines, the people running the show, the editors, the managing editors, and you name it, farther up the line, were all Jews and were all Zionists and all supported Israel. The red line, of course, is when it gets to the point where these people can't support Israel anymore, and I don't think that's going to happen. They will do this no matter what. And as Hafsa Qara Mustafa said just the other day in another edition of Spotlight, the Western media and the Western governments cannot stand to see a powerful Muslim nation defying the Western view of how things should be and Western control of their internal politics, of their internal economies. And as long as these countries, such as Iran, are opposed to this, they will be targeted by the Western media and by the Western governments. So I think the red line really is wherever they want to put it, and if they can get away with destroying Iran, they will try, but it will come at a tremendous price. And the Americans still don't realize that Israel is their oldest enemy and greatest debtor. They went back in 1954 and burned U.S. Information Service offices in Egypt, burned the American consulate in Alexandria. They destroyed the USS Liberty, a National Security Agency signals intelligence ship. And you've had people blinded by folks demonstrating against the attacks on the Palestinian supply convoys led by the Mavi Marmara. Right. So the Americans will take it and let the Israelis kill them and steal their money and don't care about the rest of the world, let alone Iran. So sure. I think that there's no real red line there.
Well, the thing that also is perplexing, I know you have a reaction there, but I'd like to ask this question from you, Marcus Papadopoulos, if I may, because it always is somewhat of a mystery here. And Israel has said on many occasions throughout the past years and during previous U.S. administrations headed by different U.S. presidents that if the U.S., I mean, going back at least as far as Barack Obama, that if the U.S. does not do something about Iran, that Israel will go ahead anyways with or without the U.S. support and attack Iran. How true do you think that is?
Well, if Israel is meaning that it would carry out a surprise air raid over the skies of Iran, targeting sensitive Iranian military installations, then yes, I believe that is very possible, and I think that is well within the means of the Israelis. If, of course, the Israelis are talking about conducting a sustained military offensive against Iran, then I find that very difficult to believe that the Israelis would venture down that road, so to speak, because there is enormous distance separating Israel and Iran. They are not borders, they are not neighbors, and therein would pose a logistical nightmare for the Israelis if they were intent on conducting a sustained military operation against Iran. But, as I said moments ago, if they are talking about carrying out surprise air raids against Iran, then yes, that is possible. But allow me to shed another dimension to Israel. During the conflict in Syria, Israel publicly, openly treated al-Qaeda fighters who had been wounded in battle against the Syrian army. And let us not forget that Al-Qaeda was responsible for the massacring of civilians in New York, in Washington, in Madrid, in London, in Bali, and so on and so on. And yet here we have Israel treating wounded Al-Qaeda fighters in Israeli hospitals. But then that should not come as a surprise, because as a former director of Mossad said only a few years ago, Al-Qaeda is not an enemy of Israel's. And we also know that Al-Qaeda has never once threatened to attack Israel. Indeed, Al-Qaeda has never used any profanities, has never used any denigrating language about Israel. So it is very clear that there is an unofficial alliance between Israel and Al-Qaeda, as there is an unofficial alliance between the Americans and the British and Al-Qaeda.
Final question goes to you, Michael Springman. All of this is happening in terms of the threats, at least the most recent ones, by Israel against Iran, during the time that at this point nuclear talks, if they are going to be continuing, that it's still something that's alive, even though it's on life support. Do you, and many are saying that, you know, Israel is trying to make sure that U.S. does not succumb and bring Iran back to the table and have a deal made. Do you think that that is the intent that Israel has?
Well, Israel, yes, certainly doesn't want a deal, because they want to keep pointing the finger at the wicked and evil Iran that is supposedly developing all these nuclear weapons in fact, isn't. So the Israelis don't want a deal. The American government, with Joe Biden and his Zionist State Department and CIA and Director of National Security, are all opposed to Iran. They keep putting condition after condition up there, insisting that Iran submit to controls on its missiles, that Iran submit to the range of its missiles, that Iran stop supplying fuel to Lebanon, which no other country is doing so far. They're doing their best to alleviate the suffering of the Lebanese people. They support Syria and the attempts of the Americans and the Israelis to destroy that government. So it's basically, yes, Israel does not want a renewed joint comprehensive plan of action. And I think that if that happened, then people might start asking, well, why doesn't something like this apply to Israel with its hundreds of atomic bombs, great amounts of poison gas, and vast amounts of deadly bacteria?
Thank you very much for that. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guest, author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman there. Thank you for your comments. Marcus Papadopoulos, thank you, historian, analyst, and author there from London. And at the top of the spotlight, we had Mona Kandio, correspondent from Ramallah. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Mikko Vitale, the entire team is goodbye. Until next time.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
U.S. military lies unnecessarily dragged on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, says Paul Antonopoulos Ryder in an article published under the heading, Top U.S. Generals Blatantly Lied About Afghanistan and Iraq Wars to Advance Their Careers. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. According to the Pentagon's annual reports on military justice, there have been more than 1.3 million cases of discipline in the U.S. military since 2001, mostly relating to the so-called War on Terror. But as The Intercept highlighted, the generals who misled Congress and the American public about the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have not only avoided repercussions after conducting a disinformation campaign for 20 years, but were instead rewarded for their deceivingly positive assessments. When they retired with generous military pensions, they landed high-paying jobs on corporate boards, further profiting from their disingenuousness, Peter Moss wrote in The Intercept. Following the terrorist attacks against the U.S. on September 11, 2001, then-President George W. Bush took his country into destructive wars against Afghanistan and Iraq. What also followed the 9/11 attacks was an outpouring of ignorance, racism, and violence against supposedly Muslim-appearing Americans. This even culminated in the murder of Indian-born Balbir Singh Sodhi by 43-year-old Frank Silva Rook, who during his arrest shouted slogans like, "I am a patriot, I stand for America all the way, and I wish that my punishment would be sending me to Afghanistan with a lot of expletive weapons." Sodhi's murder is considered the first post-9/11 backlash against non-Christian America. However, Rook's actions and calls to fight in Afghanistan was not in isolation, and in fact, many Americans with similar extremism joined the military. The wars in Afghanistan and Iraq saw entire infrastructures destroyed, hundreds of thousands of civilians killed, millions of refugees, and over $6 trillion of American taxpayer money wasted. Much of this devastation was caused by American troops, often with impunity. In fact, the Americans were not alone in such war crimes, with many British, Australian, and other troops from partnered countries responsible for murder, rape, extortion, and theft in Afghanistan and Iraq. What is most concerning, though, is that the upper echelons of the U.S. military had little to no concern for the war crimes perpetrated by NATO forces. Instead, they focused on creating a narrative portraying the situation in Afghanistan and Iraq as constantly improving. Journalist Craig Whitelock's new book, The Afghanistan Papers, provides evidence that military leaders knew the war in Afghanistan was failing but lied about it. Colonel Bob Crowley claims in the book that every data point was altered to present the best picture possible, and Whitelock described the military's positive assessments as unwarranted and baseless that amounted to a disinformation campaign. The main question is why the top military leaders were adamant in their claims that the war situation in Afghanistan and Iraq was improving. It can be suggested that their lies about the situation in Afghanistan and Iraq was motivated by self-interest to advance their own careers in capital.
They were certainly not going to allow the deteriorating situation in Afghanistan and Iraq, as well as over 1.3 million cases of ill discipline in the military, including rape, torture, and murder, ruin their prospects. Take, for example, the current U.S. Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin. During the 2003 invasion of Iraq, Austin was the assistant commander of the 3rd Infantry Division. The intercept recounts an exchange in May 2013, just weeks after the U.S. captured Baghdad, between Austin and Dr. Kashab, director of the Dora oil refinery. No matter about Kashab's insistence that Baghdad was more crime-ridden under U.S. occupation than under Saddam Hussein's rule, Austin could only say that 2 months ago was a brutal dictator who killed thousands of people. Austin, who from the very beginning of Iraq's occupation insisted everything was fine, eventually became the commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, then took charge of Central Command that covers all operations in the West Asia region, retired with $15,000 a month pension, and then joined several corporate boards, including the board of directors of United Technologies Corporation, the military contractor that merged with Raytheon in 2020. With these corporate gigs, he became a multimillionaire with a $2.6 million mansion that boasts 7 bedrooms, a 5-car garage, 2 kitchens, and a pool house in the Washington, D.C. area. Along with Austin was also David Petraeus, who at the start of the Iraq War was a major general. But as The Intercept authors recount, Petraeus was doing what pretty much every general who served in Iraq and Afghanistan would do: stringing together any data he could find that would masquerade as a narrative of success. The statistics on his PowerPoint were vintage Vietnam. Find big numbers and call them victory. In 2007, Petraeus was named the commander of U.S. forces in Iraq and hailed as a savior. He then went on to command U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan from 2010 to 2011. Although Petraeus assured Congress in 2011 that the situation in Afghanistan was improving, Whitelock's book notes that military officers in the field knew the blizzard of numbers meant nothing. One of Petraeus' advisors in Afghanistan, Sarah Case, recalled how she suggested ideas to stem corruption in the U.S.-backed government in Kabul, but none of those plans were ever implemented. She wrote, "I responded to request after request from Petraeus until I realized that he had no intention of acting on my recommendations. It was just make work." In late 2011, Petraeus then headed the CIA, but in 2012 was caught sharing highly classified information with his wife and resigned, avoiding felony charges and lengthy prison sentences that haunt the likes of Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden. Following the CIA, Petraeus was rewarded with a lucrative partnership at the private equity giant KKR, securing his wealth in his retirement years. Effectively, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have been allowed to drag on for the second decade because those at the very top of the U.S. military were more concerned about advancing their own careers. By doing so, the United States unleashed thousands of troops with similar thinking to Frank Silver Rock that wanted to exact revenge on those they held responsible for the 9/11 attacks, thus resulting in countless NATO war crimes against innocent civilians.
Good morning.
From the heart of beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.